Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. My name is Carl Shinneman. I'm the Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Jurinov, and have been an entrepreneur in the e-discovery records management field for the past dozen years. I'd like to welcome our live guests and future download guests to the first of many ESI Bytes shows. Our goal on ESI Bytes is to offer highly educational content in the electronic discovery field free from vendor pressures to educate anyone interested in ESI at a price anyone can afford, which is free. Since ESI can be an expensive field, which can literally bite you, I like to think of this show as a bargain for obtaining information from experts. It's a bargain not only in price, but also the fact that as a podcast, you can download the show and listen to it and share it with others when you have time. So why not in the e-discovery field move in this direction where you move information around? The goal is to offer an NPR-like program on electronic discovery. Hopefully, we're going to cut through biases, get to the heart of important issues, and any of you who've listened to my past shows on BNA know that getting unbiased information in a collaborative setting is what I've always tried to achieve, and I'm hopeful that this show is going to keep those core values. Some of these shows will be interviews with experts around the country to get their insights into electronic discovery and electronic records management. Other shows are going to be like this one, where we focus on a unique topic. So let me know if you're interested in doing a show in the future or you have ideas. You can email me at kas@jurinov.com. Now, just a couple brief housekeeping items. I have a number of questions we'll get through. At the end of the show, we're going to open it up to any question. You can either let me know you have a question by hitting *8 on your phone. I'll unmute you. You can ask a question. If you're logged into a computer at www.talkshoe.com, you can just type your question, and I'll ask it at some point. The show is going to end at about 6 o'clock in about 45 minutes, so that's sort of the time frame. Today's show, the guests are going to cover a vexing problem in electronic discovery field, how to educate small law firms and solo practitioners on electronic discovery. Having run a small virtual law firm for 2 years, I'm familiar with the fee pressures which small law firms face to collect from clients, practice law, get educated. And it's clear to me, from my perspective, most ESI education has been focused on large law firms and mega companies. In fact, this may be the first presentation anywhere dealing specifically on smaller cases. Our guests have unique perspectives on this topic, and they're both committed to solving this problem. The first guest is the Honorable John Facciola, who's a U.S. Magistrate Judge for the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia. Judge Facciola is well known in the field. His opinions are some of the most widely cited. He writes with clarity, at times great humor, offering guidance sometimes to both parties on how they should be behaving and handling ESI matters. He's been dubbed the Italian Stallion based on his dogged pursuit of missing White House emails and his dedication to seeing federal archiving laws are complied with. Some of his best-known cases are Disability Rights Council of Greater Washington versus Washington Metro Area Transit Authority, United States versus O'Keefe, Equity Analytics LLC versus London, and Peskov versus Faber. He frequently speaks around the country and has graciously given his time to the field to assist with maybe hundreds, close to hundreds of presentations around the country at Sedona Conference, Georgetown University, ABA Tech Show, Legal Tech, many other programs. And we've both spoken a few times about the unique challenges facing small law firms, and Judge Facciola agreed to give some of his time to offer his observations from the bench on a gap in knowledge between big firms and small firms on this topic and what problems this can cause, and give some of his advice from his perspective. So thank you, Judge Facciola. Tom French is a solo practitioner based in Fort Collins, Colorado at the Thomas R. French PC firm. In one of his memorable cases, Cache La Poudre Feeds, LLC versus Land O'Lakes, he found himself defending the rights of a small client against a billion-dollar company in a trademark infringement case. And while he won the case, he had an interesting time navigating the electronic discovery minefields, and since then you've done a number of presentations in this area. We talked about the unique challenges of being David versus Goliath in a presentation I moderated for BNA, and in that presentation, we covered sort of a big company versus a small party. In this one, we're going to cover another issue. How do you learn about this when you're in a small firm? Last thing is that if you want to answer each other's questions, I'm happy if you do that. If I haven't thought of a question, feel free. This can be a dialogue. And I'd just like to thank you for joining me on this first show. So the first question is, first, some background information. If you could explain how each of you became familiar with ESI, first Judge Faccioli yourself, and then Tom French.
I wish I knew. I was minding my own business when I had one of many cases come before me in a discovery issue. It was called McPeak versus Ashcroft, and it involved backup pips, which were then a complete mystery to them. But using the traditional tools of a judge, I resolved it. And the next thing I know, I was being accused of creating a theory of marginal utility, which is probably the one thing I learned in economics, forgetting all the rest. From that point on, like any judge, I was confronted by a society in which information technology is changing only on a daily basis. And like everybody else, I've had to keep up with it. The only familiarity I can pretend is that I've always been interested in computers. I ran my section of the U.S. Attorney's Office for many years using my own Macintosh, and I've always been interested in computers, particularly in the area of digital photography. And that's where it comes from. And it was humble beginnings, but it's been a very exciting part of my career.
Yeah, definitely. And Tom?
Well, I spent 30 years as a trial lawyer. I was a prosecutor, first of all, and now, well, for the last 15 years, I've done mainly commercial litigation. And about 3 years ago, I was involved in a large commercial litigation case in U.S. District Court in Colorado. And this case started before the amendments, the December 2006 amendments to the federal rules came into being. And then they came into being, and those basically added the three letters ESI to everybody's vocabulary if they weren't there already. And so I had to learn about electronic discovery by doing it. Just, I had a case that involved electronic discovery. It was big stakes case. Had to learn about it. Learned about it the same way we learn about most new things, by reading, by studying, by getting to work. It's not magic how I learned about it. I just did it by doing it.
Why do you think ESI is challenging for lawyers, Judge Facciola?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. I remember I read somewhere, I don't know if it was either Boris Bittaker or Edwin Griswold, said that the passage of the Internal Revenue Code was the most significant development in the law of estate and trust since the creation of the trust. And I think what the point of that is that whatever you knew, you thought you knew about estate and trust before the Internal Revenue Code, you had to learn a whole new area in order to be an effective lawyer. The problem with the ESI is, and it's a relatively easy thing for us lawyers to stay where we belong. ESI challenges us to go where we don't belong and to learn, as Tom just said, on a fly, concepts that are can be quite fearsome in our capability to understand them. The second problem, of course, is that, as I say, the technology seems to be changing on a daily basis. I don't envy lawyers like Tom who, as they come into a case, always are wondering whether he has the adequate technical capability to handle this. I mean, there are a million vendors out there trying to sell him, the latest thing with all the bells and whistles, that this has the solution that has escaped everyone else. It's particularly challenging because I don't know how a lawyer keeps his hands on top of this ever-changing information technology.
But Tom, you were able to show that it could be overcome. What did you find the biggest challenge were? Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, one of my heroes in the e-discovery world is a lawyer in Texas named Craig Ball, and he says
Craig's going to do the next podcast. By the way, he's already agreed to. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, he's first rate. What he says is, everybody wants e-discovery to be simple, but the problem is e-discovery is not simple. It's complex, it's technical, and it's tricky. So I would never say that it is easy. I mean, that's the basic challenge. It is a brand new discipline, a brand new language, brand new rules, a brand new way of doing things on top of the way we've already learned how to do it. So it is new and very difficult, and it's not easy. It has everything to be challenging.
Well, now we're scaring all the solo practitioners. We're making great progress here. But you know, when we first talked about this, Judge Facciola, you observed there were many typical mistakes you see with ESI, sometimes with small law firms. What are some of the more common mistakes you see? And
I was at Monday night. I was at Fordham with a week ago with Judges Shinlin, Truska, and Laporte, and we were talking about sanctions. And I pointed out then, I think there was universal agreement, that if you read the cases pertaining to sanctions, they seem to fall into two categories. One is under-promising. Judge, we can't possibly do that. That's crazy. Best example of that is I remember a judge being told that he couldn't take Netscape Navigator off his computer, so he went into chambers and took Netscape Navigator off his computer. The other problem is over-promising. Judge, don't you worry your pretty little head. We'll get this done in 30 days. And the person who has uttered that has no idea what she is getting herself into. And in both of those things, the terrible thing is that the lawyer, by virtue of not having the technical capability to make a truthful and honest representation, gets away with the representation. And there is nothing worse a lawyer can do to destroy his credibility, because from that point, she has put herself in a hole and can only dig out. So in my view, the most common mistake is making representations to the court without carefully understanding the technology involved and what this is going to cost and how much time it's going to take. Constantly being surprised by ever-moving goalposts and how much time is needed to do things, what kind of technical ability is needed to do things, is about the worst way to approach these questions.
And Judge, if I can segue into this, one of the big differences I think for e-discovery is that it changes when you get consultants involved in your cases. And I think what it means is that you need to get a consultant involved on your behalf, not an expert, but a consultant to help you with e-discovery early on.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. Because poor Judge Grimm and I, we in our emphasis on the lawyers needing technical capability, it's been said of us behind our backs, I'm sure, that we're the best thing that happened to vendors since they started putting their names on their T-shirts. So I'm glad you said that, and I didn't.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I'm a one man band. I usually get hired by other firms to do their trial work, but I'm acutely aware of cost considerations, but. It's almost an unequivocal rule, I think, that you have to have somebody help you out who knows more than you do about computers. And you got to hire somebody early on, and we'll talk about why that is, but you have to hire somebody early on so you know what you have, and so you can produce, and so you'll know what to ask for as well.
Exactly.
Yeah, actually, we can jump into the cost question right away. This is sort of the big question I think a lot of small lawyers are concerned about. If we accept there's a serious problem here, how do we get ESI knowledge in the hands of small law firms who have no money and are pressed for time constantly? Especially some of the joke about many solo practitioners is they're often jacks of all trades, masters of none. Tom, you've lived this. How do you advise people on budgets to get their handle on this area?
Well, don't take the case, you know, if you don't have some money. I mean, that's kind of what it boils down to, and that sounds pretty elitist and means, oh, just the big rich people get to take these cases. Well, I mean, that's kind of the world we are in. It is a more expensive world to do discovery and to get cases ready than it used to be. There's no question about that. Most of the serious e-discovery fights that I've been involved in have been in U.S. court, in U.S. district courts. So those are almost by definition bigger, more expensive cases. And I say, don't get involved in those bigger, more expensive cases unless your client can carry the freight or you can carry the freight, because it is going to cost you more than you think it's going to cost you.
I couldn't agree with Tom Moore. Now, from a judicial perspective, this is not good news. I mean, in McPeak, I said I was terrified of what was happening here, that we were, you know, going to have a federal court system in which we were spending $300,000 to search for a single email. And I questioned whether a court system that could survive that, whether disproportionate resources could lead to a result that had nothing to do with the justice of the cause.
Your Honor, I have to ask this question. question and lead into your answer right now, because I thought of McPeak versus Ashcroft, and your great quote in that case that I think is off-cited is, American lawyers engaged in discovery have never been accused of asking for too little. To the contrary, like the Rolling Stones, they hope that if they ask for what they want, they will get what they need. And I think the corollary for small firms is a concern that George Harrison wrote. It's going to take money, a whole lot of spending money, to do it, to do it, to do it, to do it, to do it right, child.
Yeah. But that's – Tom is quite right. But it's not something that we should all get up and cheer about. Something is badly wrong here. And it's going to take an extraordinarily devoted and conscientious judiciary to make sure that imbalance is somehow righted. Certainly – The one survey I've seen, which is relatively recent, by the American College of Trial Lawyers, again, lawyers are saying that expense is out of all proportion to what the case may be about, and we're rolling a rock, a very big rock, up a very long hill, and only time will tell if we're going to get there. If we're wrong, there's a lot at stake. If we're wrong, then people are going to continue to jump away from judicial forums to other fora for the resolution of their civil disputes. And if this is done on the basis of wealth, then we have really failed as judges.
Okay. All right. Tom, you've been in David versus Goliath situations, and Judge Facciola, you get to see firms of all sizes in front of you. Do you see any gap in ability to work with electronic discovery between large firms and small firms?
Well, I'm usually the small guy going against the big guy, so that's the only situation I can usually talk about, and I've been involved in serious litigation against the U.S. government. Obviously, that's about as big as it gets. And quite frankly, what I see it more as a gap of the gap is between good lawyers and bad lawyers. I mean, good lawyers know the rules. Good lawyers know what they're supposed to do. Good lawyers won't get involved in litigation and make promises that they can't meet. Bad lawyers have all of those infirmities, have all of those problems. And I think it's just a matter of, if you're in a small firm, you better learn the rules, you better figure out what the rules are, get involved in the case if you want to and you can afford it. And the cool thing is, the silver lining for me is that if you have a small client, there are lots of huge advantages to going against a Goliath, because if you don't have any paper and they have lots of paper, it's the best of all worlds, I think. It's a great situation. And you may be setting them up for all kinds of sanctions and doing the wrong thing, and you don't have any paper that you have to worry about. That's one of the reasons why I like doing the David versus Goliath kinds of cases.
Yeah, but we also, Tom's quite right, but it's an interesting development in the case law that David has got, it may have as many problems as Goliath. We are now dealing with the electronically encumbered plaintiff, the one who has the Facebook account, where those pictures that he doesn't realize how they're going to be used against him in litigation and so forth. Then we have the electronically encumbered plaintiff who uses both the boss's computer for the boss's work and her work, who has a personal computer. So I think lawyers have to appreciate this is now a knife that cuts both ways. And I think when they talk to their clients, there must be some very clear understandings about what's out there that this lawyer should be should be worried about. I mean, Tom and I are both trial lawyers, and I know what Tom says to his client in that first meeting, and that's this: I don't want any surprises. Is that right, Tom?
Absolutely.
So that's a whole new area that the small practitioner has to think about a lot. Okay, I'm going to ask for this, but what are they going to ask from me, and am I ready to handle that? What's out there? What has this person told the world in emails and Facebook and MySpace? What's out there?
And it was perhaps unfair to have Tom jump in, have answer the question first, because he likes being David. But Judge Facciola, you get to see firms of all sizes in front of you. And do you see any gaps in ability in working with electronic discovery between large firms?
Well, I am seeing the development, and I think this is now a national development, that some of the larger national firms are developing an extensive in-house capacity with electronic discovery shops. So I do see, not merely in terms of big and small, but I do see firms that have decided that this is a profit center and intend to build it up. And those people really have a significant advantage. They have that advantage, I guess, because the market has indicated there is a market for them. But as Tom said, I think big and small is not the whole story. Effective use of the resources you have is infinitely more important. But is there a discrepancy? Yeah. Is it narrowing? No, it isn't. I'm afraid it's getting bigger. In other words, there are some people who have just opted out of this whole situation, and as I think Tom agrees, they're heading for trouble. Heading for trouble, and it's very, very scary in terms of what disciplinary authorities may do to them if they blow a case because they just don't know what they're doing.
Yeah, I don't know how you can opt out of electronic discovery. It's like saying, I'm going to opt out of the rules of evidence, or I don't want the rule against perpetuities to be involved because it's too hard. I mean, that doesn't work. You just can't do that.
Yeah.
Tom, since many lawyers listening to this show might not have any experience in electronic discovery, can you offer a brief overview of the steps in a case where electronically stored information can be at issue, how you sort of approach it?
Yeah, the first thing you do is, I think you got to find out what you got. And that may typically requires hiring an outside vendor, unless you have a very sophisticated intellectual, an IT person who works for your client. So you got to find out what you got. You got to find out what your information systems are, because there will be reciprocal ESI obligations, which means that you're going to have to produce your ESI, electronically stored information, and the other side's going to have to do the same. So the first thing you got to do, I think, is figure out what you got. And unless you're very sophisticated, you can't do that by yourself. The next thing that may have happened already is you may have already gotten an evidence preservation letter from the other side, which means the other side is saying, you better hold on to all your ESI. You may have to, you're probably going to have to evaluate what your evidence preservation obligations are, and you may have to put into place what's called a litigation hold, which means that you can't destroy any of the ESI during the course of the litigation. The other thing that's really critical is that under Rule 26, what I call the meet and greet obligation, which used to be often is a joke. It's like, you're supposed to talk to the other side about what's going on and what the discovery is, and you kind of blow that off, or you have a five-minute conversation. Well, it's harder to do that these days because Rule 26 now requires you to talk with the other side before the scheduling order and realistically talk about discovery issues. If you don't know what you have, and you don't know what it means, and you don't know where it is in terms of electronic discovery, you can't possibly have a meaningful meet and greet. What difference does that make? Well, at the scheduling conference, the judge is going to enter orders having to do with what discovery will be produced, and what formats, what has to be retained. So what this means is that early on you have to have a very good handle on what electronic discovery your client has.
Okay. Judge Facciola, one of the things that I found with lawyers is they're oftentimes scared of technology, just in general. And based on some of the experiences I've had with small firms, I found that's almost, an epidemic among small firms. How do we help firms and lawyers become more comfortable with technology?
Well, I think it has to start. It probably has to start. I mean, one of the things that I don't know if Tom agrees, it's distressing to me, is that when I thought about this, I would thought that the young kids coming out of law school, the Nintendo generation, that they would have a greater capability. But when I talk to them, they tell me there has been absolutely no emphasis in law school on the technical side of the legal issues they are asked to confront. It's all very ethereal and briefs and so forth and so on. And when they go into the marketplace, they're overwhelmed that the learning curve for them is just as bad as it is for everywhere else. So I think we really have to go back to basics and see how we can increase it. As Tom has said, there's nothing any of us can do about this. I mean, as Tom just said, well, let's not have any electronic discovery in this case. Pal, Jiffy Lube has a computer, and there's nothing you and I can do about that. So I can't imagine that 100 years ago, lawyers were saying, gee, I don't want to learn any of that stuff about airplanes. Well, God, I don't know anything about airplanes. Or 200 years ago, I don't know anything about railroads. One of the great things about being a lawyer, and one of the reasons society looks to us for leadership in this area, is that we have shown a remarkable ability to adapt the law to the changing society around us. That's what we're supposed to be doing. How do we get an exemption from that? There is no answer. There's no magic wand that Tom and I have that we're going to push over you and you're going to, you know, tomorrow you're going to walk into the office and, you know, understand this stuff. You're going to have to get the books out. You're going to have to talk to people. You're going to have to educate yourself in every way. I don't know. And that's just as true as of judges as it is of lawyers.
Tom, you mentioned the importance of bringing in an outside expert right away in some of your early cases. Is that something that's challenging to pay for, or you know, do you have to do this, or?
Well, you know, have to. I don't know. Is it a really good idea? Sure. Does it put you ahead of the game, or at least where you need to be? Yes. How do you pay for it? You know, you got to pay for it. Either you know, the lawyer pays for it up front and gets his client to pay him back later on, or the client has to pay for it up front. I mean, it's one of those deals. The truth is, I don't see in state courts or in criminal cases, I don't see much electronic discovery worry, concern going on. It is, in my experience, it is largely in U.S. district courts. So that's, you know, I mean, I guess that's kind of good news in a way, but it's also kind of frightening in a way because the electronic discovery issues are still in cases that are in the state courts and the criminal cases, even if they aren't getting the attention that they get in the U.S. district courts.
Yeah. And we're seeing a very curious phenomenon here in the state court side. There is a general fear that this is just going to be hideously expensive. So at one point in our history, the states would simply take the federal rules of civil procedure, the federal rules of evidence, and incorporate them into their law. While that is happening in some states, other states are bucking and are very concerned that left to its own devices, this could swallow their system because the expense of electronic discovery will be out of all proportion to the cases before them. That's a very important development that has to be watched very, very carefully in terms of the state courts and where they are going to go. Because if they're already terribly under-resourced in terms of their physical capabilities, where they're housed, and what they pay people and all of that, if they're left out of this process, it could have a very devastating impact on the justice that most people in our society call upon.
I'll give you a question that a family lawyer asked me to ask that ties right into that. He'd recognize your reputation in the field, Judge Facciola, but he was concerned about appearing in state court where opinions can sometimes be more political because it's in a political position oftentimes. And this attorney thinks that they can prove spoliation. They don't want to invest in the work if the judge is just going to yawn and move on to the next part of the case.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's one of the, you know, that's a political concern. But you know, how do you educate judges on electronic discovery so you're less fearful on that, I guess, is, you know.
Well, you have to devote the resources to that problem. And the resources take a lot of different forms. That is, you have to not only support the judge financially so he can attend Sedona or listen to podcasts or what else, but you also have to give her sufficient time to do it. And you also have to work on integrating that lawyer into what the bar is doing in this area so it becomes natural and normal. But judicial education is difficult given the burden that most state court judges have with absolutely impossible calendars. And it's a challenge for the states, and the states are just going to have to rise up and meet it. Or I don't believe we can have a society that's sophisticated electronically, and a judiciary it isn't. I don't know how you do that.
Yeah, actually, I don't want to forget that. I want to do a show at some point on educating judges, because I think podcasts are really ideal for that since they're free and you can download them.
Yeah.
But that's a different day.
It's been my constant experience with judicial education. First of all, you got to get the judges out of their courthouses and isolate them in some place, okay? Because there's too much of a temptation to run upstairs. And that's the way the federal judiciary does it. And those are extremely important ways to do it. To devote 2 days to doing nothing but learning this area. That's crucial.
Now,
that's a nice segue, because I think if I were listening to this and I didn't know, or if I was a newbie, if I was just trying to figure out what was going on with electronic discovery, I'd be saying, well, what do I really need to do? Here's what I did. I mean, I read the rules. I read the amendments to the rules. I read the comments to the rules, to the new rules. That sounds kind of basic, but that's what I did. And then I read everything I could get my hands on that Craig Ball wrote. So go to craigball.com. And I don't get any money for saying this, but Craig Ball knows what he's doing. He's a lawyer in Texas. He used to have a trial practice. He doesn't do that anymore. He's a forensic expert now. He knows what he's doing. Read everything on his website, because it's really good stuff. And then get a copy of the presumptive order governing electronic discovery that judges like Magistrate Judge Schaefer in the U.S. District Court in Colorado enters in every case, his presumptive order. And then you will find out what he expects for electronic discovery. A U.S. District Court case in Colorado from, you can find it on PACER, 07CV2223. And read his presumptive order regarding electronic discovery. That will let you know what you need to know. Yeah. Those are good places to start, I think.
And also, I think there's something very important here. If you compare this point in history with other points in the history of the development of the practice law in America, can you ever imagine a time when there were more resources that you could prevail upon? You have this remarkable thing on your desk that searches all of the information in the world. There are now sophisticated groups like Sedona and Georgetown that are producing excellent materials that are also available on the web. There are several law firms and other people who simply have, on a daily basis, are producing reasonable recent developments in the law. There are wonderful blogs like Craig and Ralph Losey and all of that. So I think the exact converse is true. There's probably never been a point in the education of lawyers where they had more free and wonderful resources at that command. And, you know, not taking advantage of that, it's very hard to understand that.
Well, the judge has mentioned a number of times Sedona and the Sedona Conference. Sedona Conference, I'm not a member of that, but it's kind of a, among other things, an electronic discovery think tank. Mm-hmm. I think their website is sedonaconference.org.
Yeah.
And they have kind of like presumptive rules or suggested rules, kind of like the restatement about electronic discovery. And these are the guys who think about those hard issues and come up with the rules. If you want to learn more about kind of where things are going with electronic discovery, what the people who think about it think, where they think we should be going, go to sedonaconference.org.
And in the interest of full disclosure, I should say that I'm on the advisory board of the Sedona Conference with somebody named Craig Ball.
Hey, and you can also get an RSS feed to this show, as we'll be doing more and more of these. Going back to McPeak, I suppose getting more of a laser of what's involved in your case, and I know right now the inclination for a lot of people is just to opt out of ESI in smaller cases. Are there times when that makes sense, and there are times when this is just a really bad idea?
Well, look, there's no law that says there has to be electronic discovery in every case, all right? Obviously, there are cases in which it's not going to be called for. But the whole thrust of the federal rules, the amendments, was a notion of proportion, that there would be electronic discovery which would be no greater than was necessary to do what discovery does. So I don't think it's a question of opting out or opting in. If you opt out, you may be ignoring something terribly significant. For example, you could argue, I suppose, well, this is a domestic relations case which doesn't involve electronic discovery. But think for a minute. The family banks on the Internet, right? They communicate with the outside world through their email. I understand when things go poorly and the wife thinks that the husband is cheating, she's been known to put a GPS in his hubcap, all right? And strangely, in a way I find odd, I'm reading that electronic discovery is becoming very important in domestic relations cases. So when you opt out of this, and you and the person on the other side say you're not going to go there, you better be very careful, because if it emerges or develops that there was something there was terribly significant. I don't know what you tell your malpractice carrier when he says, well, what the heck did you do? And you say, well, the other guy and I agreed not to go there.
I was talking recently with a small law firm, about 20 attorneys, not quite a solo practitioner, but still struggling with this area. And they were in a situation where they subpoenaed a third party for email. It was one of their document requests and received zero emails. And they're not sure what to do. Clearly, there should have been some emails provided. But, you know, what do you do when you don't have an email-driven case, but you think the other side's lying, being unresponsive, and it's a small case? And Zubilake got really interesting when emails weren't produced and there was a search of backup tapes. But with third parties, I mean, these are the sort of things that lawyers are dealing with out there that haven't dealt with this type of issue before.
If you have somebody who's an expert, he can talk about, you know, the likelihood that there would be no emails in this kind of situation, which is no likelihood at all. Is that expensive? Yeah. You can file a motion to compel. You can write a compelling brief to the judge explaining why in this world it simply doesn't make sense that there should be no emails. There's fascinating statistics about the number of emails in this world, how that are sent every day, the number of how all of us send, you know, an average of, you know, 15 or 20 pieces of electronic communication a day, all those kinds of things. I mean, you use your creativity, you spend money if you have to, but judges aren't stupid if they realize that the likelihood that there's zero emails is zero.
Yep.
And so they're not dumb. They know what's going on.
And I think also, as Tom was saying, you can't participate in a realistic and intelligent discussion of this with the lawyer on the other side if you don't know what you're doing. So before you get to the subpoena stage, and I think you should pick up the phone to the other side and say, here's what I need. Can you help me, and can we work this out somehow? And you'll be amazed how willing the other side is to do that, because they want to avoid a giant expense as much as you do. In this situation, if they have stonewalled you like this, then Tom's advice is perfect. You got to go to the wall. And in our society, saying that an organization of this size doesn't have emails is going to be a very hard sell for the judiciary. But if you've gotten to that point of confrontation, maybe you missed the ball a little earlier on. This whole party thing of third-party subpoenas and the cost was very much a problem for the draftsmen of the new Federal Rules Amendment. And if you read the advisory comments to the additions and amendments they made to Rule 45, they emphasized how important it is to diminish the burden on third parties. Now, there's a very interesting case that came out of our circuit just this last month, or maybe it was January. It's called In Re Fannie Mae Security Litigation. I don't want to bore everybody to tears, but it's an interesting case to look at to see what happens when a third party gets in the middle of this. You know, as they say, when the elephant stands, the earth trembles. And by the time it was over, this small little agency had spent millions of dollars trying to comply with a single subpoena. So when you find yourself in this Rule 45 context, and you are either going after the third party or you are the third party, bear in mind that the courts are probably going to insist that the burden on that third party be no greater than it absolutely necessary has to be.
Okay, we're into what we said would be the last 10 minutes of the show, so I'm going to start asking a couple of the questions that people had emailed me before the show. Tom, do you have any suggestions for a small firm in terms of investing in hardware or software to be prepared to handle a case in electronic discovery?
I'm thinking
about things like document management.
Yeah, the truth is Adobe Acrobat is very good unless you've got millions of documents. If you have hundreds of thousands of documents, Adobe Acrobat won't work. But Adobe Acrobat is a very stable, very good platform for most of my cases, and that's what I use for most of my cases. I don't use the fancy platforms. If you have a big case with tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or more documents, then you may need to go with software like Summation. Summation basically requires someone to enter data in about all your exhibits, but then you can find it and, you know, do searches and all sorts of really cool but very expensive stuff. But I say, don't go to Summation unless you're pretty convinced that Adobe Acrobat and PDFs are not going to work for you, because it will work in most of my cases. I think it will probably work in most cases except the very big ones.
Okay. And actually, I'll ask your opinion, Judge Facciola, on this question. As a corporate lawyer who doesn't litigate but represents many business owners, they want to be in a position to advise their clients on the topic of electronic discovery and record management. Do you have any suggestions for corporate lawyers?
That's welcome news. If Tom and I could tell you one thing, it's infinitely easier to work on these problems before they get into litigation than it is after litigation. So I think what has happened so dramatically in this area is corporate counsel is now being involved very early on in the creation of universal records management policies that will meet the company's needs whenever litigation comes. As recently as an hour ago, I was talking to conferencing with some very sophisticated people in this area, and they said this is the way that the technology is going, that corporations cannot pay outside counsel the fees that they want, particularly in this burdened economy. So now the whole records management is going in-house, with the lawyer playing a very significant role in its creation and its justification. The theory being, if we can find it in-house for our own purposes, then we should be able to meet any discovery demand made upon us. And that's infinitely easier doing it right in the first place than trying to scramble and do it right after you get sued, when, you know, a lot of eggs have been scrambled.
Okay.
So that lawyer is in a very happy position. I'd be in my client's office tomorrow morning about 9:30, telling them, "Thank God, how do we set this up? What do you want to do?"
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. That's.
Let me just say, there's also even a thing called the Association of Record Managers and Administrators.
ARMA. That's right.
Yeah. So you know, you can, I mean, that's one of the things you can do is go to these folks and get involved with them and figure out what they're doing. You don't have to, you know, reinvent the wheel if it's already been invented.
Yeah, and there are other associations that are growing up in this area of in-house counsel and electronic discovery. I don't know all of their names, but they are based in some of the large cities, and these are lawyers who, from an in-house perspective, get together and discuss mutual concerns, and they produce a lot of good information through this agency. I apologize for not knowing its name, but that lawyer, I'm sure, can find it through the web. There is a specific association of in-house counsel who concern themselves with electronic discovery.
Okay. I don't know if there are any questions from the audience. You could hit *8, I will certainly ask your question. One last question, just to give someone a chance to think of a question. Judge Facciola, you had talked about some of the ethical issues or concerns that if a lawyer doesn't know this area and they handle a case, do you see these situations, from your perspective, where you think people are close to this?
Yes, I have seen it in one hearing before me. I saw it in my own eyes. It was the sanctions for child pornography are ferocious, many years in prison, and we were dealing with a case where an FBI agent posed as a 12-year-old girl and was instant messaging with a guy who was trying to solicit him across state lines. And we got into the question of instant messaging and how this was re-recorded and how it was being managed, and the lawyer got up and said, "You know, Judge, I just don't understand this computer stuff." Well, that's a violation of the Sixth Amendment. I can't think of a more obvious example of ineffective assistance of counsel. That's really scary. The other ethical issue, and it's a fascinating one, is when the shoe is on the other foot, which is, you know more than opposing counsel, and the question is whether you can exploit his ignorance. For example, if he proposes search terms and you know very well they can't possibly find what he is looking for, are you under some obligation to correct him? At a recent symposium at Mercer Law School in Georgia, Jason Barron devoted his thinking to this issue in an article that I hope will be published there. But there is, I don't know what Tom thinks, there is this business of taking advantage of the other person's ignorance that raises some tough, tough legal issues in the context of an adversarial system.
And you know what? The whole thing that led me down this path of small versus big, which I think is an interesting thread, and small in general, was at a conference where everyone's talking about meet and confers and how you've got to collaborate and work with each other. And I said, what if one side's bigger than the other? And there was laughter. So you got to help the other side. I think you're right. It's a challenge. Interesting challenge.
Yeah, there's one argument to be made that it's an adversarial system, and and if he doesn't know what he's doing, that's his problem. There's another side that says, well, that adversarial system is tempered by a notion of professionalism and collaboration. So
yeah, we are initially officers of the court.
That's right.
Okay, well, I don't see any questions popping up here. I want to thank both of you for hopefully helping start a fire of information, helping some of the smaller firms and solo practitioners get more comfortable with this. Any last thoughts you want to emphasize, either one of you, and then we'll call it a day?
I say don't be too scared by electronic discovery. I mean, I think it's another fascinating area about which you get to become an expert, which is why I like being a lawyer. You know, you get to be an expert about all these things that you don't know anything about. Well, take that as a challenge and a cool thing and something to keep you fresh and vigorous, even though you've been doing this for a while.
To underline Tom's point, isn't that why we became lawyers in the first place? Because we wanted a generalized way of looking at the world and coming at it from a lot of different angles. Hey, we conquered the rule in Shelley's case, for crying out loud. The rest is easy, right?
All right. On Shelley's rule as an analogy, I think we'll end the show. I'm going to stop the recording, and if you guys just want to hang on for one more minute, that would be great. Okay?
Sure.
Thanks, everyone. And these shows will be housed at ESIBytes, BYTES.com, probably about 3 or 4 weeks. But thanks again.